So tonight we're going to be talking about what everybody in the world seems to be talking about, which is China. We hear a lot about China in the news. We hear about their policy, their digital media policy. We hear about trade wars. We hear about the ecology and economic issues. And how much of that do we really understand or have a good grasp of what it means when it comes through our radios or through our televisions? So tonight we're hoping to get a fuller picture of China in the world today, the history of China, the role of China, and how it relates to us here in the United States. So here with me to discuss China, the myth versus the reality, and much more, we have the inaugural executive director of the University of Texas at Austin's China Public Policy Center, David Feierstein. Thank you for joining us tonight. Also from the Media Studies Department and from the Department of Sociology, we have Dr. Wenhan Chen. Thank you for being with us. From the LBJ School, the Lloyd M. Benson Jr. Chair in Government and Business Relations, the eminent economist James K. Galbraith. Thank you. So let's start out just by getting a sense of how you're all coming to this idea of China. David, talk a little bit about your history and relationship to China and what you're doing here at UT.
Well, thanks so much. It's a real honor to be here. And Rebecca, thank you and all of you for the precious gift of your time. Let me just say a couple of words to kind of contextualize my engagement with China over many years. I'm from Austin, Texas. I went away to college, came back to UT for graduate school. And then embarked on a career in the Foreign Service for a total of 18 years and worked mostly on China, including about 5 years overall in Beijing at the U.S. Embassy, and also worked on Russia and worked for about 4 years at U.S. Embassy Moscow, which was an interesting couple of places to spend time as a U.S. diplomat. And then after that, I went into the think tank world, worked for the East-West Institute, also on China and Russia. And just as a parenthetical note, at one point in my job at the East-West Institute, I worked on China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran at the same time. I don't know what I did in a past life to deserve that, but whatever it was, I must have had fun doing it because I definitely had some challenges dealing with all of those countries. And then I was very, very privileged and humbled to be able to come back to my beloved alma mater, the wonderful University of Texas at Austin, and to be the inaugural or founding executive director of the China Public Policy Institute, China Public Policy Center, rather, at the LBJ School of Public Affairs. And let me just say also that predating all of my academic, collegiate career, et cetera, studying China and the language and international relations, what first got me interested in China was when my folks in 1984, when I'm dating myself, but I was in between my sophomore and junior years of high school, they were going to take a trip to East Asia, specifically to the mainland, Chinese mainland, to Taiwan, to South Korea, Japan, and Hong Kong. And I had the opportunity to go with them on that trip. I was the last kid still in the house. And we went on that trip. It was very eye-opening and formative for me. And made some friends on that trip during the several weeks we spent in China. To this day, those friends are still my friends 30-plus years later. And so that really opened my eyes to this extraordinary country that was just beginning to sort of engage the world. And I had this sense that it would be a neat thing to do to study China, to study the Chinese language, and in the hopes of ultimately going into the Foreign Service. So that's where it started. And it's been an incredible journey, and I couldn't be more privileged or humbled than to be back at this extraordinary university at the China Public Policy Center.
And tell us just a little bit briefly about the China Public Policy Center. What is the role? Why was it set up, and why now?
Well, thank you for asking that. And let me just say a couple of words. So everyone here knows that the University of Texas is a world-level university, and our motto is, what starts here changes the world. And a number of us, starting around 2016, started talking about the fact that given its economic heft as the number two economy in the world, its colossal importance to the United States and to the world, that the university could do even more on China than it had been doing. And so based on that conversation and starting with that conversation, I submitted a proposal to the university early last year, 2017, to say, here are some thoughts about how the University of Texas could do more in engaging China with a special emphasis on policy, because the university was already doing and continues to do a stellar job training young people in Chinese and Chinese history and culture. The faculty here in Asian Studies is second to none, but we weren't doing as much as we as a university could do in the policy area. And so I presented those ideas to the university, initially to the dean of the LBJ School, Dean Angela Evans, and ultimately to President Fenves. And thanks to their visionary leadership and to them believing in this idea, we were able to create a new center at this university, the China Public Policy Center, on August 28th of last year. And I think it's part of the university's overall effort under the leadership of our extraordinary president, Greg Fenves, to internationalize the operations and the substance of the university and to engage more with the key players in the world today, of which, of course, other than the U.S. itself, China is probably the single most dominant global player. And so in that spirit, we've created this center, and I'm absolutely humbled and very honored to be able to lead it.
So Wenhan, let's move to you, because you know you study media. And what is it specifically about China that you're interested to look at in media?
Well, David just mentioned the 1984 when he visited China for the first time. I remember 1984, I was in fifth grade. And I also remember 1984, I watched this national parade celebrating the PRC's 35th anniversary from a teeny tiny black and white TV set in my parents' living room. And we had to write an essay about the 35th anniversary of People's Republic of China. And everyone felt at that time a new era was coming to China. And I left China actually 20 years ago in 1998 because throughout the 80s and the early 90s, the Chinese intellectuals were asking this question, look at the US, look at Europe, what happened to China? Why China did not develop capitalism? Right, that was a question back in the 1990s. So I decided to go to Germany to study sociology because this question was originally raised by the great German sociologist Max Weber in his very important book, The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. So I studied 2 years in Germany. But at the same time, my husband went to the U.S. and studied in Louisiana. That was back in the late 1990s. As David knows, as a diplomat, almost impossible for a Chinese national to get a visa when your spouse was already in the country. And my husband still does not speak German, so we decided to migrate to Canada. So 6 years later, I got my PhD in sociology from the University of Toronto in Canada. And somehow, as fate would have it, my next job was a postdoc at Duke University. And never ever in my wildest dream, I would end up actually in Texas. So Rebecca asked me, okay, you are a media sociologist, yes, my dissertation was actually about how Chinese entrepreneurs use digital media technology, internet at that time, to develop a transnational entrepreneurship between US and China, and that's the research helped me to get a job in the Moody College of Communication.
Yeah. And so media has always played a big role in how you've understood national identity.
Exactly. And I think not only in China, but also across the world, media increasingly play a very significant role for citizens to get their information, for the public to form their opinion about many, many issues. But increasingly today, not just the conventional media like TV or radio, but increasingly social media becomes so important. It's become actually really the probably the most important source for our information, inspiration, of course, also entertainment.
Yeah, and I have to have a disclaimer because when Hung and I are doing an op-ed fellowship together, which is how I got to read her work on digital media policy in China in the first place, and what her work is in Scientific America specifically, she has published a piece on digital media policy in China and what it can teach us here in the United States. And I would encourage everyone to read it. It's really phenomenal. And we'll talk a little bit about that later. James, but I'd like to turn to you and the economy. Talk about how what you're seeing in China and all of the rhetoric that's happening around the economy right now, what speaks to you about our position and the place of China today?
Okay, well, first of all, let me say that my main qualification for being here tonight is that I have the office next door to David's at the Elder Jesuit. And I have a number of connections to China. One is that a 25-year marriage under the discipline of the People's Republic, my wife is just here in the audience. Partly as a result of that, by extremely strange chain of serendipity in the early 1990s, I found myself in the position of serving as with the elaborate title of Chief Technical Advisor to the State Planning Commission of the People's Republic of China for Macroeconomic Reform. That's a real mouthful, isn't it? My instinct, which I think proved to be correct, was largely to encourage their instincts and persuade them to keep as far as possible from the mischief that could be wrought by other Western advisors. And this was at a moment when they were sensitive to that advice because of what was happening in Russia right next door. And it was a time when there really could have been any number of directions. It was 4 years after the Tiananmen massacres, and a great deal of turmoil and turnover had occurred in the Chinese government at the time. But they were able to maintain a course of, let's say, gradualism, but not stagnation, that has allowed a transformation to occur that has a number of dimensions. One of them, of course, is the opening to the world economy, which has created a Chinese presence of a dramatic clarity in the trading relationships with much of the rest of the world that wasn't there 30 or 40 years ago. But the other is, and I think vastly more important, is an internal transformation. China 40 years ago, and even 30 years ago, was still predominantly a rural country with a number of large cities, but it was nothing like the urban mega country that it has become. And in the course of this process of urbanization and development, a number of things have happened. One is that the Chinese people are, by and large, with the exception of a few hundred million, which is not a small number, but in the Chinese context, dramatically smaller than it used to be, it's not a poor country anymore. And the other is and I think it's obvious to any visitor, that you're looking at some of the most modern and advanced and comprehensive development that has ever gone on anywhere in the planet. And that is a fact which we, I think, need to appreciate in its full scale. And it's one of the consequences of it is that China is developing an outreach to the world, which is based in part upon an engineering capacity, a development capacity, that it had fostered successfully over the course of the last 30 years. That's the, I think, the main message of the of what's called the One Belt, One Road initiative. And it's, of course, also becoming a major source of demand for the products of much of the rest of the world. So if you look at what happened in Latin America over the 15 years after 2000, the commodity prices improved and a great deal of poverty reduction and social progress occurred. Much of that was fueled by the fact that the Chinese were out in that market buying up those commodities at good prices and basically sustaining a long period, the first substantial period of economic growth that those countries had seen since the 1970s. So you're looking at a player on the world stage of really immense consequence, and one which cannot be made to, cannot be wished away, cannot be made to go away, one with which we're going to be dealing for the indefinite future.
And there is, you know, this kind of economic stability that China is experiencing right now is crucial also, from what I have understood, to the social contentment of the people as well. So with that in the milieu...
I've never met a contented Chinese. I don't know what she's actually talking about. David might have some other experiences, but...
Well, Noam Chomsky has said that as long as you keep people satisfied economically, you know, social unrest is unlikely to occur. But if there's an imbalance there, then we'll see a lot more social unrest and people will blame the government. Is that, you're shaking your head, James, like that's just wrong.
It's not my sense of, it certainly wasn't my sense of the place when I was there regularly in the 1990s. It was a place full of social unrest, full of conflicts, and that was what propelled the process of reforms, was a series of problems that had to be dealt with. There was not a complacency. And sometimes the dealing with the protests many times was not very nice. It's a rough neighborhood. But the fact that these problems are coming up and they have to be dealt with, they often surface, by the way, at the governmental level in the form of budget deficits, very traditional fiscal problems, but often as social, as protests, upheavals, strikes, all kinds of things that then become ultimately priorities for the problems that have to be dealt with. And I think the great one right now is the environmental issue. I would think at least one of the very important ones is the fact that there's been so much poisoning of the environment in the course of this development that it's become a major, major crisis.
Wenhong?
I think this is a great question you ask. And this really fit into the title of this discussion, China Myth and the Reality, because very much like the U.S. or any other big country, China has a huge population, and there are so many layers of complexity over there. And if you look back the last 40 years, obviously, the quality of life has been greatly improved across the board, from the major cities to the very, very remote communities. But as James already pointed out, still there are many issues there, like pollution is a big issue. For instance, I come from Beijing, right? I had these fond memories when I was a little child. The sky was so blue, right? The crispy blue in spring, in fall. We could see, you know, the mountains afar, right? And right now, the air pollution in Beijing gets so bad that the government really had to have this heavy hand to close many factories near Beijing. And this is also a reason now they are developing Xiong'an as a city that will actually bring some of the population from Beijing to Xiong'an to reduce some of the urban issues. And also talking about social mobility, in the last 40 years, the economy grows so fast, it's created unprecedented opportunities for entrepreneurship. Like the wheels that has been accumulated was amazing. And for many people in my generation, it was really from rag to rich over 10 years or 15 years, I could tell you that like back in the early 2000s, when people like me who live in the Chinese diaspora in North America or West Europe, when we return to China for vacation or visit our family or friends over there, we feel pretty rich, right? But now, if we go back to China, we are just ordinary members of middle class, if you are lucky, right? But there are still, you know, a lot of issues, not just the environment, but the social mobility for young people, in particular those living in small towns, right? And I met with friends from Sichuan province last week, and she shared with me what's going on in her hometown, right? Like still, you know, many people, they have to rely on money sent back from family members working in big cities because there were now many jobs for the young people in the local community. So there's a great, I would say, local variations and the imbalance if you go from the big cities to the small towns, to the less developed west or northern area of the country. So so it's very difficult to provide a very consistent, one-size-fits-all picture of the country. That's also why we have these imaginations about what's going on there. Oftentimes, you know, all these facets are true. Depends on which perspective you want to look at.
And what you mentioned about the environmental issues is directly linked with global capitalism. And so the United States is implicated also in, you know, the environmental issues in Beijing. Can we talk a little bit about what is going on with this trade war and how these economic issues are going to influence both areas and both countries? Go ahead, David.
Well, a couple of quick points. Number one, let me just make one point on the broader sort of thrust of your question from earlier. I do perceive that there has been a kind of unspoken social contract in China that has obtained for some decades now, basically since the beginning of the period of reform and opening up in 1978. And that is basically stated from a Chinese Communist Party perspective, you, the people, stay out of politics, and we, the party, will make you wealthier than you ever dreamed you could be within one generation. That's the basic compact that I think has existed in China. And for many hundreds of millions of Chinese, and noting that there are significant exceptions and that not all growth has been felt evenly, or not all wealth creation and prosperity has been equally distributed by any means. The fact is, many, many hundreds of millions of Chinese have lived that compact. And within, not just in terms of their grandchildren, but within their own generation, within their own lifetime, people who never dreamed that they could possibly own an automobile have families that own two, three, or four automobiles. And the problem now is, which license plate do you use to be able to drive into the city when they restrict it by the last digit of your license plate? So you go from never dreaming that even your children would own a car to actually owning more than one family vehicle yourself. And the list of examples could go on. Electronics, travel, everything that seemed like it was forever out of reach to many hundreds of millions of Chinese is now within the reach of many hundreds of millions of Chinese. So I think there has been a kind of social compact, and it's something that you sort of, you either accept it or you don't, but that's the social compact on the table because of the nature that the Chinese regime is. Now, the point that I would make is that I think what we're seeing now is that there is a shift in the terms of the social contract. And so if before it was we, the party, you know, you stay out of politics, we, the party, will make you rich beyond your wildest dreams within one generation, now it is you stay out of politics, and we will make you prouder of your nation than you've ever been in your life. That is the essence of what the Chinese themselves refer to as the construct of the rejuvenation of the great Chinese nation. So instead of saying, we'll make your family rich, which indeed has happened for many hundreds of millions of Chinese, now we're saying, we'll make you proud again as your ancestors were X number of decades or centuries ago. I don't mean it facetiously when I say that it would be very fair and accurate to portray the Chinese leadership ideology about the country, if you were to sum it up in a few words, make China great again. That is what this leadership has explicitly stated it intends to do and seeks to do. And I think that if you look at it through that lens, many of the things that the Chinese leadership in the person of President Xi Jinping and others have talked about doing are now designed, having attained very substantial level of prosperity, the number two economy in the world, many hundreds of millions, if not even a billion, lifted out of poverty, to start thinking about the nation as a nation and to start thinking about, from the Chinese vantage point, restoring China's rightful place in the world. And that, I think, is the transformation we've seen in terms of social contracts. Again, unspoken, but I think very real to all involved. Briefly, and perhaps we'll talk more about this topic, on the issue of trade, we are clearly in a rhetorical trade war already. For the most part, no one has yet pushed the red buttons on most of the things that have been threatened. Some of the red buttons, if you will, have been pushed. Certain sectoral or particular sort of categories of tariffs have been put into effect or are imminent. Most of them have not been. I think that if you simply look at the rhetoric, it's a very alarming situation, one that could have a pretty profound impact on our nation, on our farmers, on our ranchers here in Texas and across the country, on our workers, on our businesses, likewise for China. And I still think, although it may sound counterconventional, that there is time for the leaderships of both countries to sort of look down the abyss and see that ultimately both sides can hurt each other approximately equally and pull back from the brink of what could be a potentially very consequential and damaging trade war. And I hope that that's how things play out. I think if we see, and there are a lot of things one could say, but I think if we see China taking steps as it has even in recent days, in terms of, for example, opening up its automotive industry to full 100% foreign ownership, something that had never been the case, starting to take steps to try to open up the Chinese market to a greater degree, because there has been a massive asymmetry in the level of market openness between the United States and China, no question about that. If China starts taking real and meaningful steps to deal with the underlying problem, which is ultimately market access and the asymmetry and, frankly, unfairness of the bilateral trading regime, it won't take too many of those signals, I think, from China to signal to the Trump administration, okay, we get it, and to potentially avert a very consequential and negatively consequential trade war. So the point that I would make about the trade war is it's very much in the news. The rhetoric is very heated, probably more heated on our side than on the other side, but it's heated on both sides. The threats are there. But when you distill the problem down to core actions, I don't think the boat has yet gone over the waterfall, and I think we have a chance to avert a potentially tough situation.
And there's so much in that that I want to talk about tonight, because there's this idea of the national project, right, and the role that food plays in the national project, and the role that food plays in this trade war, and also the idea that global access to Chinese markets and vice versa would be a good thing. You know, I mean, that there's this, there's an underlying assumption that it would be a good thing. Who knows? Would it be a good thing? Is that what would that mean? So let's take any part of that question and talk a little bit about that. Wenhong?
May I ask the audience a question? How many of you believe in the American dream?
We got a few takers.
Only a few takers. 2018, how many of us here asked you believers of the American dream?
One. Ten.
So what David described early, this make China great again, is actually pitched as the Chinese dream in China. First proposed by President Xi Jinping back in 2012. At that time, it was interpreted as the great restoration of the Chinese people. And now it's often translated as rejuvenation because China has 5,000 years history according to the myth, rejuvenation of the nation. And here comes the question. What's the difference between the American dream and the Chinese dream? What's the difference?
The thing that stands out to me is that the Chinese dream is a national dream. The American dream is an individual dream. And that gets at what I think is a core civilizational difference between the United States and China.
But there's still the question of access to imagination, access to a dream, you know, access to an idea. Is that an equal process for everyone?
I think President Xi was really, really smart in calling this term the Chinese dream. On the one hand, it integrates the American dream. It's for everyone, every citizen, to have a better life, to have much higher quality of life, to be successful, to achieve their dream. And on the other hand, definitely this is a national project. There's a national collective dimension of it to make China a strong nation in the world. So now if we look at this similarity and the differences between the American and the Chinese dreams, you can see where we are with this trade war. Because on the surface, of course, it's about the huge trade deficit between US and China. But on the other hand, if you read this Section 301 report published by the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, about a 200-page-long document, you can immediately realize that it's not just about trade. It's not just about steel, not just about soybean. It's actually about the competition between U.S. and China in the area of high-tech industry. So back in 2015, the Chinese government released this plan called Made in China 2025. And it's been a very ambitious plan to develop China's high-tech industry. Actually, the plan was fashioned by the German concept of Industry 4.0. Because in China, both the government, but also many elite in the industry and academia feel very clearly, if you look back the history, China obviously missed the boat of the Industry Revolution 1.0, 2.0, 3.0. And now for Industry 4.0, China wants to be the leader. And the Section 301 report talked a lot about U.S. feeling a little bit threatened by this Made in China 2025 plan. So yes, a lot of rhetorics about trade, treaty visit. I think luckily the both sides are now back to table and start negotiating. But the larger picture is really about, okay, 5 years from now, 10 years, 20 years down the road, which country would be the leaders for the next generation of technology?
James?
I want to bring this back to the very prosaic topic of automobiles. It's something at least I can get my mind around. When I went there in 1993, I remember asking how many automobile companies were producing in China. This, of course, at that time was, most people's vision of it was as of a communist country. The answer was there were 103 of them, which is to say practically every car company in the world had an operation in China behind a very high tariff wall of 100% or so, which meant they could produce a very bad car at small volumes and sell it at a very high price. It's good business for just about everybody, except the Chinese consumer, who is obviously getting shafted. And eventually they dealt with this by lowering the tariffs to 25%, wiping out a great many of these companies and bringing in a big company. I think it might have been GM to produce at scale in China. I was, to the extent I was involved in this, I was opposed to it. I suggested to them that the future did not lie in choking their cities with cars, but with something more like the European model, the much more balanced transportation system. This did not succeed, and I'm afraid that the one thing they've done, and that David was describing, not the only thing, but this big thing that to make people rich, is also something that has deteriorated the quality of life effectively compared to what it could have been if they had done something else. But I think the point to draw from this, and I would to bring it up to the current trade war, is I would not expect the Chinese government to do anything that smacks of a concession or something that they don't perceive to be in the interest of their development strategy, and certainly not something that would appear to be a concession for precisely the reason that David and Wenhong were talking about. This is conflict with the image that they're trying to project. So what's going to happen? Well, first of all, the first thing to remember is that trade wars are, as the man from Vaudeville said, as he ran out on stage, don't clap too loud, it's an old theater. On the first week of March, in a Republican presidency, in the year of their first midterm election, you get a tariff on steel. It happened in the Bush administration. It happened in the Trump administration. You go back before that, you can see similar things in the Reagan administration. I'm not sure the timing was exactly the same. But this is what Republican presidents do when they need the votes of the Western Pennsylvania on a special election or because they see a wave building up against them in certain parts of the country. It's not something to take. In the Bush case, the tariffs lasted for a couple of years and they're taken off. This is not the beginning of a isolationist world in which we will all be rebuilding our own backyard steel furnaces in order to meet our demands. It's just not going to happen that way. So I think that's very important to bear in mind. What does happen, there are, of course, disruptions. Sorghum ships have to go someplace else, and costs of transshipment add a few thousand dollars to per shipping container to Chinese goods coming to the U.S. This kind of thing, to avoid whatever tariffs are put on, all happens, so there's a little cost associated with it. But the main thing that happens is financial. It hits the stock prices of the affected companies. How many of you out there have your retirement in Boeing stock? If you do, I have to say, you missed your chance. You should have sold. The time now is to buy more. This is the effect, and we see this politically because this affects the balance sheets of wealthy people, so they come back and lobby for restraint, and that's, I think, what we're going to see. Will we be able by bottling up American technology to withstand the Chinese investments in their own technical development, not in a million years will we be able to have an effect on that or any significant effect. It is not the case that all of the great technologies emanate only from the United States. It's possible to get these things from other places, including from your own scientific and technical resources, of which the Chinese now have a very ample supply. So we should not make ourselves into a kind of sense that great things can be accomplished from either a national security or development contest strategy by engaging in this. I think going forward, I would be a little careful on David's point about the national greatness, because it's important to remember that this was a country that had a revolution in 1949. It's already had a period of assertion of its national importance. Now, very difficult times, obviously, in the period since then. But it's not as though this is a country which is emerging freshly, at say Cuba was in 1959, from a period of humiliation. It's been an independent country for a long time, a nuclear power since 1964. We're dealing, I think, with there may be something to what you're saying about the popular stoking of emotions, but we're dealing with a country which has a very mature presence in the world and has had, I was in India in 1962 when the Chinese came over the border, and there was a huge panic in India because the Indian troops were not capable of withstanding the PLA. But the Chinese did exactly what they said they were going to do, stopped and withdrew. It's a country which is, doesn't need lessons in how to conduct itself, it seems to me, at least on the world stage.
Is that true, though, on the media stage, on the social media stage? How important is it for China and the Chinese nationality to have a presence in social media? Wenhong.
Wow, that's a big question. it depends on which social media you are talking about. Right. See, for instance, Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook are still trying very, very hard to get back to the China market. They've been blocked since 2009, and since then, Mr. Zuckerberg has been on this charming offensive. Right. He visited China multiple times. He starting from 2010, learning Chinese. He gave talk at Tsinghua University, in Mandarin. He recommended President Xi's book, The Governance of China. According to himself, he's posted on Facebook. He bought copies for his colleague so they could understand China better. But still, even today, the global social networking service, Facebook, has Facebook, Instagram, or WhatsApp are still not available in China without VPN, right? And there are actually a lot of analysts point out even today, Facebook got access to the Chinese internet users, and I think more attractive to them actually was this 750 million mobile internet users, right? Even they got access today, they are actually not in a position to compete with indigenous Chinese social media companies like Tencent, like WeChat right now is the biggest app or social networking service in China. And if you are interested in, how the conventional media, like TV, newspapers, and social media may discuss the U.S.-China relation differently, obviously there are a lot of differences. I would say on social media, people are more, say, open. So you would see, you know, more liberal opinions, but also more conservative opinions on WeChat. But oftentimes, those controversial topics would get censored, deleted, if you are too late to check that out. And you know there are a time difference between China and the U.S. So oftentimes, when I try to check my friend's post, it's already gone, right?
Go ahead, David.
Just to add one thing to that, I think it's important to remember the fundamental reason why Facebook, Twitter, and basically all of the U.S. social media are banned in China. And the reason is because of what they represent. What they represent is an ability, and what they offer is an ability to organize laterally amongst your fellow citizens in a way that is not controlled by the Communist Party of China. Now, you may say, well, but there are Chinese social media platforms such as WeChat, which reportedly has 900 million users. But the difference is that those platforms can be controlled and are ultimately controlled by the powers that be in China because they're Chinese entities operating principally in China. Facebook is not, nor is Twitter, nor are any of the others. And so, if you're the Communist Party of China, the thing that you don't want to happen is for people to be able to laterally organize themselves on a massive tens or hundreds of millions of persons scale, because then people can start trading ideas and thoughts and, hey, I have this new idea, why don't we fill in the blank? And that becomes a very dangerous proposition for the powers that be in China. And in fact, the powers that be in China view that as an absolute existential threat to their existence. That is why, no matter how many Xi Jinping books that Mark Zuckerberg buys and gives to his employees, fundamentally, there is no space in a regime style or regime type like that of China for a foreign-owned social media platform that allows tens or hundreds of millions of people to organize themselves without the involvement or orchestration of the Communist Party of China. That's why these entities aren't there. That's why these entities will never be there so long as the regime type in China remains the way it is, which will be, in my prediction, my estimation, for a very, very long period of time.
May I add something here? Please don't feel sorry for Mr. Zuckerberg. Facebook actually has offered itself as this advertising platform for Chinese businesses to reach the global market. So I think many of you know that Facebook has more than half its revenues from overseas market outside of the U.S., and China is actually their largest market in Asia Pacific.
Thank you. I'm trying to get my emotions under control. I think I'm succeeding.
Well, let's open things up to some questions. Jack or Amy is going to come around with a microphone, so just raise your hand if you have a question. There's one right in the back here, and another one right there, and one in the front. We're good to go.
Sorry to take you off the perspective regarding economics, but if you are the Communist Party of China and you want to understand how to navigate this imbalance of men, quantity of men who are single versus the women available to them, what might you study? Would you study Catholic priests? Would you study Mexican immigrants coming into the United States, for example, Mexican men leaving their families behind? And the other question, kind of light, the gentleman in the blue shirt between you two women. You mentioned
David.
You mentioned the red button, and since red has such a different connotation in China, what might it be?
What color might the button be in China? Is that the question? Well, okay, let me come to that one second and tackle the easy one, which is about the fundamental demographic challenge that China faces that's existential. And that is, of course, as you rightly note, there is a very substantial asymmetry in the demographics basically generated by a civilizational and cultural preference for boy babies over girl babies. And it has generated a gap of basically tens of millions at the same age cohorts of folks of marriageable age, et cetera. So it is a very profound problem. It's more than a statistical anomaly. The premise of your question is absolutely right. And the truth is, I don't know that there is any public policy problem out there or public policy phenomenon out there that could be studied that is comparable in scale to the nature of the deficit or the asymmetry that China's facing in terms of the significant imbalance between boys and girls and young men and young women, particularly at the marriageable ages. What you do see a lot of are efforts on the part of Chinese men of that age, where there are literally deficits of eligible brides in terms of just the numbers aren't there, to then try to marry foreign brides. And that's something that's very common in certain parts of the country where you see this. You do see some level of immigration out that where people feel like they have better prospects both professionally and personally, including around the fundamental issue of finding a mate, a partner in life. And I think it's an inherently tough issue. There is not an easy or, by definition, quick fix. And you see these efforts to just try to cobble together some type of a solution set. And, of course, let's also note, you do see some instances of very reprehensible kinds of activities, such as the kidnapping of women, and obviously in these scenarios, forcing them into marriages that they don't want. And so there is a very nasty underbelly to this particular problem, but I don't think that's the norm. It happens, it's real, but the big problem is basically people are going to have to go overseas and they're going to have to look, if you will, to incoming foreign folks to, you know, deal with the kind of marriage gap that you see there. And you're right, red is an auspicious color in China. It has been for centuries and millennia. It's obviously, in a sense, the national color of China now. But I think the metaphor of the red button is one that works across cultural lines, nevertheless. And there are colors in China that have different connotations than they do here. White, for example, is often referred to as a color of mourning. But it's true that red does have a very positive and auspicious connotation there.
Chinese stoplights are still red.
Indeed, they are.
I don't want to make light of this issue, but there was a moment when our youngest daughter was 11 or 12, and she was wandered into a part of a park where she found that the trees were all plastered with pictures of young people, and there were middle-aged parents hanging around hoping to find spouses for them, and she found herself cornered briefly by a broker who asked if she could cook, if she could sew, if she was available. And she answered those questions in her very capable Chinese until she finally found a way to escape into an art gallery. And I got a detailed letter by email that evening recounting this whole escapade. So that's an unusual scene at this point. Yeah.
Was that in Shanghai?
No, it was in Fuzhou.
Another question?
Hi. Go back to the trade war again between the U.S. and China. In fact, I think this is the only thing that Donald Trump is doing right. I actually support him in terms of this trade war. China is playing unfair. And the Chinese economy, in my opinion, is much weaker than people from the outside looking in appears. It doesn't really have that many fundamental technology. What it sells to the world is really low-tech stuff. Even if you take cell phone, for example, the OS is Android, the CPU is from Intel or Qualcomm. So the success of Chinese economy, in essence, is keeping the Chinese Communist Party in power. And I don't know, from Chinese perspective, I'm not sure it's a good thing in the long term. I want the Chinese Party to be weakened, so that's a true, genuine Chinese culture and Chinese political system to flourish instead of this Chinese Communist Party, which is dictatorial in nature, as Xi Jinping has become dictator for life And it is a Western utopian philosophy somehow get spread to China. So I do support Donald Trump. I want this trade war to happen, and I want the party to be brought down. Hopefully, I mean, that's just my personal opinion. Thank you.
Yeah, could I just respond to that? First of all, thank you so much for sharing that comment. And let me just say one thing about then-candidate Donald Trump and now President Donald Trump, which I've said over the last year and a half, and I think it bears reiterating. One thing that I think Donald Trump deserves credit for is that he managed to communicate, in my judgment, to the Chinese that the current overall bilateral trade relationship between the United States and China had become and has become fundamentally unsustainable politically in the United States, full stop. Now, when he ran as a candidate for the Republican nomination, as a candidate for president, we all understand that Donald Trump spoke a lot about China. He rarely got the facts and figures right, but that doesn't matter as much. He was speaking about China metaphorically. He was using China as a symbol or poster boy for basically everything that was wrong in the eyes of a significant swath of the American electorate with the global trading system as perceived and felt by average middle-class Americans. That message got through. It didn't matter that he never got the number, the figure for the U.S. deficit with China right a single time in the campaign. I don't mean that facetiously. It just didn't matter. He wasn't really talking about China. He was using China as a kind of symbol or symbology to really talk about a fundamental sense among the American people, a good swath of the American people, that haven't seen incomes rise, that haven't felt that they've benefited from China's accession in 2001 to the WTO, and so on. And the corollary to this is when he became president-elect and became president, he made it very clear to the Chinese, in my judgment, that whatever, to cite a line from the movie Hangover, I don't know how apt that is, but to cite a line from that movie, whatever this is, it ain't working for us. And he got that message, in my judgment, across to the Chinese leadership in a way that no U.S. president of either political party had done prior to his being emphatic about that with the Chinese. And to summarize it another way, what Donald Trump helped the Chinese come to understand, in my opinion, is that whereas the Chinese had always looked at its relationship, China's relationship with the United States, and felt that it was somehow unfair to China, it was Mr. Trump that said to the Chinese, no, you've got it all wrong. It's unfair to us, and it has to stop right now. And whether one likes or doesn't like or supports or doesn't support Donald Trump, I think it is, in fairness, fair to give him a good amount of credit, consistent with the ethos of your question, to say that this is someone who signaled to the Chinese that this can't go on politically because, if I can put it somewhat facetiously but accurately, essentially what Donald Trump was saying was to the Chinese was, and these are not his words, they're mine, overlaid onto him, if you don't fix this problem, you're going to get 4 more years of me. And because this is the problem that elected me. And my personal view, and I'll stop here shortly, I don't mean to hog the mic here, but my personal view is that he got the message across to the Chinese in 2017. And I think my personal view is if we had not gone down the road of this rhetoric on trade war, where we threaten $60 billion and then we threaten $100 billion and we do this and it's all by Twitter and so on, I actually perceive, and some would disagree, but many might agree with this, that the Chinese were already on the cusp of realizing they needed to make significant changes, and that actually predated the tough rhetoric about tariffs, but it goes back to this campaign of 2016. So credit where credit's due, like him or not, and there are many different opinions, et cetera, or at least 2 different opinions in this country, this is someone who I think got the message across in a bright, bold, clear way, in a way that the Chinese understood. So I'll say that.
I'm prepared to give extremely grudging credit to the president's negotiating style, which is described with respect to North Korea as two dogs barking at a chain link fence. But then, you know, at the end of the day, you can see what's happening. It often happens when dogs do that. It's a with respect to the substance of the Chinese situation, I think zero credit is what's required here, because it overlooks the fact that the decay of this strata of American society and American geography, this region of America which delivered the election to Donald Trump, is a product of our own policy. It's not a product of China. It's a product of the fact that we've built an economy which is bicoastal, which has finance and insurance on the east side and technology and aviation on the west side, and which has not redeveloped the older industrial areas that were built up in the 30s and 40s and 50s and which have gone through a cycle of decay and neglect and the resulting resentment. This isn't because of China. The automobiles didn't come from China. They were coming from Germany and Japan and Korea. They were being built in Tennessee and in Alabama. That's where the regional differences arise from. So I think what he's offered is a political symbol which holds out the prospect of change when there is in fact zero prospect of actual remedies coming from this. And the mix of what, as I think the gentleman pointed out, the mix of what the Chinese sell to us and the mix of what we sell on the world market are really quite different. Where I would disagree a little bit with the implication of that analysis is with the idea that you can't this is a fragile basis for the Chinese living standard. I don't think it is. I think what was in fact brilliant, maybe accidental in some respects, but brilliant about the way things worked out for China, was that it solved the one problem that no socialist country had ever solved. Which was to build a large consumer goods industry that could effectively meet the needs of its own population. And nobody wanted to buy Soviet goods or Polish shoes or what have you. And you had because they were producing according to mandates that did not, made things appear shabby. But the Chinese didn't do that. They built up exceedingly diversified low-tech industries, which eventually meet world standards, but in the meantime flood the domestic market with perfectly serviceable goods. And this means that a large part of the population can afford these things and live in ways which, you know, are perceptibly similar. You walk down the street in a city in China and you're looking at a crowd of people who are just as well dressed as you are, and if you were students here, I would say considerably better dressed than you are. There's an obvious, I think, benefit to having pitched the redevelopment in the open door policy toward that line of relatively low tech, but nevertheless very useful production products.
Well, I think the president doesn't need anyone to give him credit. He is an expert of taking credit, and and I know the latest news, like what's going on in North Korea, and also President Xi Jinping talk about China is ready to open the automobile market and the financial market, and many people probably feel that, oh, this all thanks to the wrecking ball approach of this president. Right, and I think in his own tweet, he said, like, you know, in this trade war, there's nothing for America to lose if you already have such a huge deficit. And if you play tough, others will appear cute, right? And I think we have to have this long-term view to think about the damage such an approach may create to this great nation.
If I could just make one sentence point and to echo what Wen Hong just said. Look, the stock market has expressed its view on the trade war. And all the gains that had been made in January when things were really ratcheting up have been lost as of this very day. Today we hit back to January 1st. And a lot of it, not all of it, but a lot of it is driven by the possibility of a trade war. Now, the business community is not that enamored of the idea. And frankly, another point worth making is that Trump, for his part, is on this issue, like many others, way outside the mainstream of the Republican Party, because generally speaking, the Republican Party has been obviously a pro-trade, free trade party. And in fact, China's WTO accession occurred during the presidency of George W. Bush and was the work of numerous administrations, bipartisan basis. But this president is out in a very different space, way outside the norms of the Republican Party on the issue of trade. And he's doing things his own way. And, you know, we'll see how things play out ultimately. And I think to some degree we'll see whether the results are what he believes they will be. And I think there's a lot of debate around that.
There is one thing I want to give the president credit for, and that is that it has to do with what's happening here in this state. This is a state which is economically very internationalist. It is led by a Republican, very conservative business community, which is oriented to the world. It has, of course, a border with Mexico, which it's not embarrassed is there. It's been a free and open border for a very long time, by and large. It's being closed up and militarized in a very unpleasant way. It's got, of course, a growing, very rapidly growing cities and a growing immigrant and low-income minority populations. And this president is accelerating its return to the fold of the Democratic Party, which is where Texas belongs. So I'm from that point of view, I think if we're looking for something kind to say about him. I stand up on that point.
And by the way, just a data point, China is within the top three for destination for Texas exports and within the top three for source of imports to the state of Texas. It's already overtaken one of our neighbors in those lists, and over some period of time may very well become the number one trading partner for the United States, and already is the number one, or closing in on the number one spot for even a city like Corpus Christi, let alone for other cities across the state. So the importance of China to Texas is monumental, and we as Texans have to get this relationship right from the standpoint of Texas prosperity.
I mean, we just barely scratched the surface of this topic this evening. But unfortunately, we don't have any more time for questions because we've already run over. But I really quickly, if you could, just leave us with one thing you want an American audience to know about China today. James?
The road is tortuous and the struggle is intense, but the future is undoubtedly bright. That's a well-known saying in my household, and I just repeat it here for your benefit.
Wen Hong?
I think between U.S. and China, there's not only a trade deficit, there's also an understanding deficit. There are definitely more Chinese international students in the U.S. than American international students in China. There are definitely more Chinese who can speak English than Americans who can speak Chinese. So I think this really a job America need to do better, given China-U.S. relation has become probably the most important bilateral relation. So I hope there will be more people like David who can speak fluent Mandarin.
David?
Couple of points. One, I think this is the U.S.-China bilateral diplomatic relationship is the single most important bilateral diplomatic relationship in the history of the world. And we have to get it right because the consequences of getting it wrong are far-reaching and not very pleasant. The last thing I would say is just apropos of just very broadly an example of how profound and fundamental the cultural differences and civilizational differences are between our countries, going directly to Wenhong's really good point about the need for more understanding and the need for more trust building between our countries, which very much are part of the ethos of the China Public Policy Center here at UT. If you had to summarize all Chinese thinking in five words, or let me do it this way. If you had to summarize U.S. thinking and Western political thinking and philosophy in five words, it would be, I choose, therefore I matter. If you had to summarize the Chinese mindset, it's, I relate, therefore I matter. And the implications of that very profound difference in how we think of ourselves as mattering lies at the core of everything about our countries. It is different. And we've got to come to terms with the deeper elements of that misunderstanding and mistrust if we're going to have any hope of getting this vitally important relationship right.
Well, perhaps our next Views and Brews will be on what is choice. You know, that would be a good one. How do Americans view choice? But for now, thank you so much to James Galbraith and Wenhong Chang, David Feierstein. Thank you. Thank you all for coming out this evening. Please join us next week for another Views and Brews, and have a beautiful night. Thank you.